The American Broadcasting Company brings you Issues and Answers.
This is Howard K. Smith in Washington. If anyone drew up a list of the seven wonders of the modern world, the American economy would certainly be one of them. In the lives of men now at middle age, its gross output of wealth has doubled, then doubled again, and then doubled again. But one of the most impressive or depressive aspects about it is that while it has multiplied our wealth, it has not distributed it well. A fifth of our people live in poverty, and we have the highest unemployed rate of any modern Western country. The president's chief stewards for this economy are the Secretary of Commerce, Mr. Luther Hodges of North Carolina, a businessman himself, who has just issued some very happy statistics about record business activity in 1963, and the Secretary of Labor, Mr. Willard Wirtz, who has had to record the other unhappy side, increasing figures of workers left idle by our economy in 1963. It may be that the most important single question before the nation is, what is this fabulous but flawed economy going to do in 1964, and what are these men going to do about it?
You've heard the issues. Now the answers from two cabinet officers who will wage the president's war on poverty. The Secretary of Commerce, Luther Hodges. The Secretary of Labor, Willard Wirtz. With ABC commentator Howard K. Smith.
What's going to happen to the economy in 1964, briefly? Secretary Hodges?
They're going to have a good year in 1964 and a renewed spirit of confidence on the part of the people as a whole.
Secretary Wirtz?
I agree, but I want to be sure that everybody's going to have his fair share in it.
Well, let me ask you, the administration is predicating its future record on a tax cut being passed by Congress for 64 and 65. What would happen if there is no tax cut, Mr. Hodges?
There would not be as much economic activity. We would lose $10 or $15 billion in our gross national product increase. We would have a dispirited situation because so many people have counted on it, including the businessmen who must make the investments.
Now, this upswing in the economy has been of almost record length. Would there be a possibility of a recession without a tax cut?
I would want to say a recession in 1964, but I think that people then began to put off any plans they have and lose a little pep, shall we call it, the man in the street, if your tax cut is not carried through.
Secretary Wirtz?
Well, I agree. I hate to reduce these things to specific numbers, but as nearly as I can, if we weren't to have a tax cut, it would mean about 2 million jobs fewer than with the tax cut. I think it'll work out about that way. I'm assuming that we're going to have a tax cut, and we certainly need those jobs.
Now, President Kennedy, about 3 months ago, made a statement to the effect that if all the legislation he's asked for dealing with the economy were passed, he would hope to get unemployment down to 5% of the workforce in 2 years. Now, you've been quoted as saying you will be satisfied with nothing but getting it down to 2%, which is a state of full employment. What has to be done to get it down to your 2% instead of that 5%?
Well, these figures, these 2%, these 3%, these 5 millions, these 10 millions, and so on and so forth, are difficult for all of us to understand. I can only say this, that with automation moving at the rate it is now, we've got to do everything we possibly can to move it down to a decent level. And in specific answer to your question, I think there have got to be two things done. One is to see to it that this economy is working just as fast as it possibly can in its private operation. And that's why the tax cut is so important. If we release another $11 billion worth of consumer goods to operate through the private economy, it's going to mean another 2 million jobs the way we want to get them. In addition to that, we've got to do these things which are required to see to it that people are trained, are educated for the jobs which are present in an automated economy. And so in answer to your question, there are two things. The system has got to be working hard and fast at its top level, and we've got to see to it that the education and the training program qualify people for the jobs that are now present.
Now, in doing research for this program, I've been reading your collected works, and I would like to ask you both, what is needed is 34 million new additional jobs in this decade of the 60s, and that breaks down to about 50 or 60,000 new additional jobs every week. Can that be done without much more government involvement in the economy, Mr. Hodges?
Yes, I think if you were able to get the tax cut and get people to trying to share the work more along the lines that Mr. Wirtz mentioned recently on the question of overtime. If you really got new things going through a tremendous amount of research and development, because we haven't had anything new, you know, in quite a while that put in large employment. You've had the space industry, which has come along. That's the last one, and it's done a very good deal. I think if you did those things and that you trained the people for the things that are here rather than training them for what used to be, I think you'd go a long ways to taking care of these people.
I hope you won't mind if we try to get away from those overall figures. Nobody knows what 34 million jobs and so forth means, although I think the figure's about right. Look at it this way. There are presently about 4 million people unemployed in this country. Now, we couldn't possibly get that down below about 2 million. That would be the perhaps 500,000 who just aren't able to carry their weight. Now, there are people who blow that figure way up, but it's a small figure. There's also another figure of people who are changing from one job to another. So we can't get it below about 2 million. Now, that means that we're only about 2 million short. And when you talk about a single unemployment problem, I believe it misses the point. We've got several unemployment problems. And the most specific ones we have are among the minority groups and among the younger workers. Just specifically, there are about 5 or 6 million teenagers in the workforce today. Now, most of them ought to be in school.
Yeah.
If we could get them in school, it would have a three-way advantage. One, it would remove that competition in the work market as against the older workers. Two, it would be giving them the training they need for the new jobs. And three, it would be making education the biggest industry in the country today. So if we could concentrate on that problem of youth unemployment, if we could concentrate on the problem of minority group unemployment, then I think we could zero in on this, and I think that's what we're doing now.
Do you think that the administration has asked for enough, if it were passed, to do all that? It's, after all, I have to come back to those overall figures. 50,000 new jobs that didn't exist before every week is a tremendous number.
If the question is whether this is going to be done without the further intercession of the government, I say that's an answer that's up to the private economy. And I hope that the private economy's answer is yes. I'm concerned about the fact that so much of the growth in the last 5 years has been in the government sector, in the state and the local government sector. I'm very much concerned about that.
Let me sing on something that I think ought to be emphasized more and more. I get a little tired of everybody in America looking toward the government at Washington for answering all their problems. This whole educational system, and I've been through this on a local level and for years on the state level, this whole education system needs to have the interest and the support, and I mean real support, at the local and state level. That's where you really need to do the job. The federal government ought to step in when the others can't do it or when it needs to fund some seed money or some inspiration, but it ought not to try to run the things for the country.
Now, I don't know the answer to your question as to whether it can be done without further government expenditure. I think the answer for now is that we're making our bets on the possibility that the private economy will do it. I think it will do it. I think if the people in this country would decide, privately and locally, to clean out their slums, to build the schools they need, to send the percentage of their children to school who ought to be sent to school, to keep them in school, sure, the problem will be met. I turn the question back to the country rather than to the government.
Howard, I'd like to make this point. I think we oftentimes not only turn too much to the central government, but we are liable to point out, as my good friend Bill Wirtz does and does eloquently, of the problems we have. But I'd like to look at the constructive, optimistic side. We've done an amazing thing in this country in these last few years in the way our economy has moved forward. And if we compare ourselves to anybody else in any other nation in the world, we're doing it. Now, that doesn't overlook the problems we have. But you've got to have these strengths that I'm talking about in order to lick the problems that he has mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You take from 1961, the beginning of this administration, for example. We had a gross national product at the low of that past recession of $501 billion. By the end of that year, less than 10 months later, we had $540 billion. Now that increase alone, Howard.
And today it's running at what?
$600 billion. That's which I'll come back to, but that increase alone in that 1 year for $39 billion was more than the total gross national product of either Canada or Japan, the two best customers of the United States.
Gentlemen, I think we ought to go into more detail on the issues you've raised, but first I'd like to ask you about something else. The thing that most Americans are interested in right now is their new president. And to me, one of the most impressive things he's done is he has invited business leaders in to see him, and then labor leaders, and both have come out and told us reporters, he's our kind of man, he's going to cut spending, he's our kind of man, he's going to increase spending. How long can he go on doing this?
Well, I think the identification has been with the basic purposes, and I think those are shared by American management and American labor. As far as the specific spending programs are concerned, I believe that there is a common denominator of national interest and purpose. Let's not spend money on things which we don't need, if there's some military installations, that kind of thing. I don't believe anybody in the country wants to spend money on that kind of thing. I think they do want to spend it on the human needs programs. And I take great assurance, great confidence from the conversation, which indicates that as far as these programs are concerned, there's not going to be any cutting back of those. Let's save the money on the things which we no longer need, and let's put it into the things which we do need. I think that's the reason that you find a unanimous approval of the approach which is being taken.
I don't necessarily, Howard, see any great difference between, even though they sounded completely opposite. Both Secretary Wirtz and I were asked by the President to sit in on both of these meetings, both the labor group and on the business group, which I think is a fine thing. Mm. We spent more than an hour with each group, and I remember the businessmen particularly, with whom I had dinner that night, saying he is our kind of man, and he speaks our language, and he used an illustration of his own little business in Texas. How he had more expenses than he had increased income, and therefore he had to do something about it. I think that you can cut spending in the various departments of the government and in the federal government as a whole without necessarily disturbing these basic programs that Secretary Wirtz and I are interested in and which we must have for the country. Because there's a lot of waste and a lot of padding, whether it's in defense or in labor or commerce or agriculture or whatnot.
Now, the most ringing note that President Johnson has struck on domestic problems so far has been his declaration of war on poverty. Now, really, to carry that out and make a dent in the very large number of people who are classified as impoverished in this country, won't it require greatly increased expenditures?
I'm not sure if you mean government expenditures. Yep. I'm not sure that that's the answer. Our largest problem with unemployment is that 94% of the people in this country are doing so well that they can't get enough concerned about the other 6%. Yeah. But I'm not convinced that concern has to come through the exercise of government authority. If they'll do these other things, they can be done privately as well as publicly. As far as moving in on poverty is concerned, if the economy is working in the way I think it ought to be working, I don't think it needs a government catalyst.
If you can save some substantial sums in the Defense Department, for example, and I would applaud Secretary McNamara for his courage and his understanding of this problem, I think that much of that money can be turned toward these things that we are talking about, along with the cooperation of the private sector and the local and state governments.
Mr. Wirtz, you've said that poverty is becoming almost inheritable in this country.
Yes.
Now, private industry is not going to educate these millions of kids who are not getting an adequate education. It's not going to renew their neighborhoods without government action. It's not going to do many of the things that are necessary to end that inherited poverty.
Not just private industry, but I'm impressed with the fact that in every community I go into, there is now a real awareness among the women in the community, among the local organizations, the volunteer, the voluntary, the private organization, of a desire to do something about this situation. I think if we can identify the nature of the poverty situation, we've got a lot of allies in this country beside the national government,
including
federal government.
Including the private sector, and I say this with close association with many businessmen and having grown up in that atmosphere, the average businessman and industrialist doesn't mind paying his taxes if he thinks he's getting his money's worth. And he is more and more seeing the need of these things we're talking about. He's seeing the need of education, both the elementary education and the higher education. He's also seeing that you've got to clean up these things. You've got to clean up the rivers as well as the slums.
Look what's been done about the most serious domestic problem we faced 12 months ago was the discrimination problem, racial discrimination. I take great pride in the contribution of the federal government to what's been done on that problem, but I respect the fact that the accomplishments of the last 12 months have come primarily from a crystallization, privately, of the attitudes of this country about this thing. I think the same thing can be done about poverty. that was done about racial discrimination.
Let me ask you about a specific category of poverty. Today, this very day, a report is coming out under your official authorship called Manpower Conservation. What it actually is a study of young people who are eligible for military service, and it brings out the astonishing fact that half of them who have been examined have been found unqualified in the United States, either due to poor education or to poor health. What about that?
I'm so glad you mentioned it. If the country would realize what that report indicates, it would get up and take action about the thing that we're talking about. 300,000 boys took the pre-induction Armed Forces qualification test in 1962. 150,000 of them were found unfit for military service. Those are today's military rejectees, and they are tomorrow's hardcore unemployed. We're going to move in on that situation, not just as a federal government, but as a nation. We're going to supply the training. 25% of the boys taking that test are found not to have the equivalent of an eighth grade education. Now, right now, we're just throwing them back. We're not doing anything about it. We're going to move in, apply the training programs, the health programs, and so on and so forth. It's an illustration of how we can pinpoint the problem we face and can do something about it as a nation.
I want to leave the federal government again. I don't like the emphasis that we in the federal government are going to do. If I were the parent of the boy who failed, I'd want to do something about it. That is the key to the problem.
But then very often the parents don't have the motivation or don't have the background to do something.
A third of these boys came from broken families.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, a very high percentage of them came from families in which there's no education as far as the parents are concerned. We're going to have to exercise community responsibility, I agree.
Yes, the community.
I agree with Luther that there's a great deal more of this thing that's got to be done retail at the local level than wholesale at the federal level.
Well, you can go down many streets right here in Washington, D.C. and find children who are dropping out of school and who can't find employment and whose parents are just not equipped to motivate them to do anything.
Let's wake up to what's involved. Let's realize that in New York there's a narcotics problem, and that in other cities there's a narcotics problem, and that in one city after another there's a part of this problem that can be met locally if we'll just face it squarely.
You think the narcotics problem...
It's very important. And the problem of broken homes. We're not going to get full employment in this country unless we've got a sound society as well as a sound economy. We better recognize it.
Let me ask you about another cause of the problem that is on everybody's lips, and that is automation. I read a very frightening book by a young economics consultant called Robert Theobald, in which he suggested that the time is at hand when the rise in the number of jobs will not only be more slow than the rise in number of people seeking jobs, but that actually the number of jobs will begin to decrease due to automation. Are we going to be able to meet this problem?
Well, I'm sure that Secretary Wirtz would want to comment on it also. But I think we have to find two things. We've got to find new things we can make more economically through a cost reduction. I think you'll get much of that through your research, both your governmental-sponsored research and your industrial research. And I think we got to learn to sell a whole lot more goods abroad. We do the poorest job of any industrialized nation in the world in the amount we sell abroad because we haven't had to. We sell less than 4% of our product, whereas our competition will sell 2 and 3 times that percentage. I think we got to do those things in order to find these jobs. I think everyone would agree generally that automation must go on. Otherwise, we won't be competitive. But the quality of the U.S. product is well received all over the world. It's just up to us now, as our own domestic economy is sopped up with our sales, to get out and sell goods and to make them more economic than we have.
Now, you were talking about our sales abroad. I read recently that we sell $4 billion more goods abroad than we buy from abroad. Can we improve on that a great deal without causing currency crises abroad?
Well, yes, I think we can improve on it, another couple of $1 billion.
Really?
Yes,
tremendous.
I do. Very well.
Well, Secretary Wirtz, really, automation is almost mainly your problem. What to do?
No, not mainly my problem at all, because let's be right clear that the expansion of the economy, the increase in the standard of living, is dependent upon our pushing automation to the fullest possible extent. Anybody who fights automation is fighting the national economy. That's the only way we can stay ahead.
Right.
As we have historically. But we've also got to recognize that the humanation side of it is just as important. These ideas that the automation, that the machines are creating automatically as many jobs as they displace, aren't proving out. Just one figure, in 1963, we produced almost exactly the same number of automobile units, automobiles, passenger vehicles, trucks, and buses as we did in 1955. Almost exactly the same number with 17% fewer people. We've lost, it's taken 150,000 fewer people to produce the same amount this year that we produced 8 years ago. We've got to take account of the fact that when people are thrown out of jobs by machines, it's a common interest to see to it that they're protected. When we do that, automation will come faster.
Now, the AFL-CIO's program is to have a universal 35-hour week and then to double the wages for overtime so that industry will hire more people instead of keeping the same people employed longer. I know the administration opposed that, but the other day you seemed to make a statement that approximated that. You said, I think that you...
No, I'm squarely opposed to simply distributing unemployment, which I think is what the 35-hour work week would do. On the other hand, when I realize that there is overtime, that's over 40 hours, when there's overtime being worked to such an extent that if it were distributed to other people, it would mean an additional 900,000 jobs, I say we better take a good look at it. I'm not suggesting just straight double time for overtime or anything of that kind. I'm suggesting taking a clear look at the question of whether there is the right distribution of the work.
Our time's running short, so I'm going to have to change the subject abruptly. I'd like to ask you, Secretary Hodges, are you in favor of more trade with the communist countries? We've almost started a wheat deal here going. What do you think?
We've got a wheat deal going, yes. I'm in favor of more trade, and I have been for quite some time, because I think we're being made to look very stupid by comparison with our allies, particularly those in Europe and Japan.
Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you a theoretical question. A conservative economist, Professor Jacoby, said the other day that Kennedy is maligned as being an economic radical. In fact, he followed in the Eisenhower line completely. The incidence of taxation did not hit the wealthy, and in general, he was a very conservative economist. What do you think of that assessment, Mr. Hodges?
Well, I'll say this. President Kennedy was far more conservative and far more pro-business, as a man in the street thinks of, than they gave him credit for. He saw the nation's needs as a whole in doing this, and so the man who wanted to take a position took a position based on what they thought he said about him. But basically, he was conservative in business matters and did many things, including tax credits and things of that kind, to help out the businessmen.
Yes. How about you?
Your question involves a comparison of presidents. I'm not inclined to get into that. I'd simply like to say that as far as the present situation, starting with right now, is concerned, it seems to me that what we've got in President Johnson is a complete combination of the realist and the humanitarian, the pragmatist, the activist,
the
person of principle.
The two
I know, I know. No, no. The question was put in terms of two previous comparisons, and that I don't like. As it is right now, it seems to me we've got the real combination of effectiveness, and I have a great hope for the future on that basis.
Well, I think Mr. Johnson's even more the thing I'm talking about than Mr.
Kennedy. I agree.
More the what?
More interested in the so-called conservative side, the business side, despite the fact that he has these what you call the liberal human ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. Our time has run out. Thank you for being with us on Issues and Answers.
Our guests have been the Secretary of Commerce, Luther Hodges, and the Secretary of Labor, Willard Wirtz. They were interviewed by ABC commentator Howard K. Smith. Next week at this same time, Issues and Answers will bring you the Secretary of State, the Honorable Dean Rusk. We hope you'll be with us. Issues and Answers is produced by Peggy Wheaton, a presentation of the Washington Bureau of ABC News.